So there's always a fear when you get up here, or at least for me. I'm sure Randy probably doesn't ever think this, but how much can one embarrass oneself in a group setting before this happens? But I had an experience on the way over here that thoroughly embarrassed me, so I thought I would share it with you just to get this out of the way, because I can't possibly do worse than, well, let's hope not. So I get in my, it's rainy, I'm running a little bit late getting out of the house. I get in my car, I turn it, my Honda Accord, I turn it on, I start driving, and there's a beeping, kind of like the seatbelt beeping, but it's on while I'm driving. And I'm having these thoughts of like, oh dear, you know, this is going to break down, you know, I'm in trouble here. I keep driving, I stop and the sound stops. I get out of the car, I look at the wheels, nothing's flat, nothing. I keep going, it's beeping, so I'm starting to panic a little bit, so I wake up my buddy who's a Honda mechanic and ask him, or tell him what's happening. You know, I said, can you hear that beeping? He's like, yeah, I hear that. And he said, is your emergency brake on? Look down, I go, thanks, buddy. And he said, well, stop the car and start again, because I want to make sure that was it. I start driving and it's doing it again. So I said, man, you know, obviously that's not it, Derek. You know, what could this be? I pull into a place, I stop, I start moving, starts doing it again. He says, is the brake all the way down? And I'm so, yeah, that's I'm going to hear about that for a long time.
Is the brake off?
I don't know. I don't know. Well, that's what I'm hoping. I don't know. We could turn this way to catch any laughter or derision that come while I'm preaching. So it could be on. So my daughter who's watching me can hear that. Remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. Do any of you remember the 5th of November? I knew you would, Randy. Anyway, oh, Tommy, a couple more. I wouldn't expect you to remember the 5th of November, unless you'd seen a movie that had that in it, but I'm a Revolutionary War reenactor, among other cool things that I do with my life. In Camden every year, and Kevin can attest to this, he's been with me, they have a Guy Fawkes night. Now, on the 5th of November, and I think it's 1605, King James was the King of England, the King James Bible. Well, Guy Fawkes did not like King James. He was a Catholic, and he had the idea of blowing up Parliament with everybody in it. I think it was well underway before it was exposed and he was caught. And at these revolution, this one event, I guess it's around the 5th of November, that's why they do it. They have a Guy Fawkes burning. And this is kind of like the British 4th of July in a way. But they burn him in effigy. They make a straw man and burn him. And although there's no British people in South Carolina, except us pretending to be as a redcoat, it gets intense. The hatred. It makes me fear a mob, I'll tell you that. But the intensity with which they act that out is pretty shocking. But the way the British remember that event reminded me of how much memory plays a role in what we read in the Bible. We're constantly being called on to remember. But you say, remember what? Well, if you were an Israelite forming on the plains of Moab, Moab, by the way, is important in our story here, but before the Ruth story, if you're an Israelite forming on the plains of Moab about to go into Canaan, you would have a guy that was very busy trying to help you remember a few things. And that guy was named Moses. And he wrote a bunch of sermons. As a matter of fact, he wrote a bunch of books to help the Israelites remember where it is they just, who got them where they were, how they got there, and what they were supposed to remember once they got into the promised land. You see, Moses wrote the first 5 books of the Bible, and just by some basic math, I can guess this. Well, he probably wrote them before he died. And he died before he went into Canaan. So he must have written them before that. And I'm guessing probably after he was in Egypt and all that kind of stuff happened. So in this window here, these first five books of the Bible, I don't know if you ever thought about this, were written to a specific group of people for a specific purpose. He wasn't just a robot that got possessed and started writing stuff down. He was writing stuff to these Israelites who had grown up believing a lot of lies. If you were to ask an Egyptian slave, who was the image of God? What would they tell? What would they have instantly told you? Pharaoh. If they had said, if someone had said, well, our job is to fill the earth with God's image, what do you think they might have looked up and saw and thought, well, that's it? The Sphinx, maybe, the pyramids. You know, that was the image of God. Well, what Moses taught them in Genesis was revolutionary. It wasn't Pharaoh that was made in God's image. It was them. They were made in God's image. It wasn't fill the earth with God's image. That idea wasn't to go and make pyramids everywhere, but to fill the earth with God's people and God's presence and God's rule over the earth, and that they were a crucial part of that. The whole earth was Yahweh's. And he made it for us to enjoy, to work it together in Eden, and to expand its borders till it filled the whole earth. You know, Genesis taught us also that we failed pretty badly in that. As a matter of fact, they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden because they couldn't hold up their end of their bargain, and it seemed like the Israelites had no land, no promise, no future. And Moses was writing to convince these guys, and I love how I beat up the Israelites wandering in the desert. Those buffoons, they're so unfaithful, right? And so I realized I'm in the exact same way. And he's trying to convince them that they don't go back to Egypt. We want to go back, they said. Look, we're wandering in the desert here. There's not much water. It's hot. I don't know what's going to happen. There's leeks and onions in Egypt. I want to go back. And Moses writes these books. If you want to know what a lot of the stories are about in Genesis, they're trying to convince them, no, go forward. Remember? What does he tell Abraham? Go west. Take over. You know, that all the stories point towards that Canaan is going to be the new Garden of Eden, a land flowing with milk and honey. Keep going. Keep going. And they had experienced something pretty amazing. You know, the God had shown up. They had the plagues, the Red Sea. I mean, they had experienced something truly amazing. And as they're gathering on the plains of Moab, Moses is writing to them to tell them to remember. Remember who you are, really are. Remember what has happened. And much of Leviticus and Deuteronomy are instructions to remember and then kind of how to live in Canaan without becoming a Canaanite. That's what a lot of the stories and the sermons in there are. But there was something important that they needed to know. That they needed to know that the land that God was bringing them into was not theirs. They didn't buy it. They didn't earn it. God rescued them from slavery as a gift. His people had been redeemed. We're talking about kinsman redeemer today. He had redeemed his people. And the word redeemed means ransomed, delivered from bondage, distress, penalty, or liability, or from the possession of another by paying an equivalent. And as redeemed people, they were to live like redeemed people. They were to remember what God had done and who they now were. People purchased by God who enjoy living in his creation. They were to act as miniature redeemers as they entered the land. And in Joshua 13 through 17, the Israelites are spread out across the Canaan, and they're given plots of land. They're giving pieces of land. And this is where things take a really strange turn for me as a modern-day guy. You know, I tend to think of my land as my land and that I can do with it whatever I want. As a matter of fact, I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, right? We're, as Americans, you know, we're supposed to, it's our stake, it's our claim, and if we can sell it to make more money and get more, you know, more of something, a bigger house or whatever, we'll do it. We'll move out. It's my money. You know, I can sell it if I want. It's my land. If I can move on to something better, that's great. But that's not how it was in Israel. Here's what in Leviticus 25, it says this. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you were strangers and sojourners with me. And all the country you possess, you shall allow for a redemption of the land. So as I mentioned before, this is the Canaan is Eden 2.0. And they remember that this is not their land, it's God's. But on top of that, guys, they're to remember that they're a community. He didn't send a bunch of individuals into Canaan to just grab a piece of the good life and good luck with it. It's your homestead. You're just like when they moved west in America. They each grabbed their piece of property and they worked it as their own and they were not connected. Well, that's not so. We were built for connection. And we were to remain connected to the land and connected to each other. This was a going back to the garden. This was a going back to the way it ought to be, the way it should have been. Not just a land grab. But I don't know if you noticed, in the last part of the verse I read, it said, in the country you shall possess, you shall allow for a redemption of the land. What does that mean? Well, just as God has rescued his people from their poverty and helplessness, if one of the families found themselves in trouble due to famine or poverty or maybe even bad life choices and were forced to sell their land, a kinsman, a family member, was supposed to take on their plight as his own. It really hits me how the American dream has swallowed me whole. That I view that it's in my guts. You know, it's shameful to need help or to ask for help. And in America, I'm a free agent. I buy and do as I please. It's my time, my money, my land. The more of it I get, the better, right? Well, that's not the way it was meant to be, guys. You're spending our lives accumulating stuff, showing the world how independent we are, is far from the biblical model. And so much how I functionally live flies in the face of this whole idea, especially as a small business owner. So much of my time is spent looking out for number one. The Israelites were bought at a great price. Their land was given to them. And when someone was in trouble, they were called to remember what God had done for them and to do the same for their neighbor. There was a duty to be a kinsman redeemer. He was to redeem the land, to pay a price for his helpless family. And in verse 25, it reads thus, if your brother becomes poor and has to sell part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. But it goes deeper than that. To protect the family line, if your brother died, and you were able, you were to marry the widow. And the first child you had was to be given that family name, and you worked the land in order to give it to them, back to them. Now think about that. Think about your life right now. I think about the business I'm running, the stuff I got to do, to take on a wife, but then having a kid, building all that land up, and then giving it away. It strikes me as odd. But it goes deeper than that. Let's say I have a family member who's off somewhere and gets himself murdered. Back in this time when the book of Ruth was written, you know, it was the time of the judges where they had no king and everyone did as they pleased. Well, if my brother was murdered somewhere, it was my job to execute justice. I was called an avenger of blood. In remembrance of how much God had purchased and rescued them, and more than even that, at the end of Leviticus, God says this. He says, and he, meaning the person who might have been displaced from his land, if he is not redeemed by these means, And he and his children with him shall be shall be released in the year of Jubilee. For it is to me the people of Israel are servants. They are my servants, my brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You ever heard about the year of Jubilee? I've heard of it, but honestly, until I got asked to preach a sermon, it really just something I'd heard of. Right? I'd probably skimmed over that passage, like the rest of Leviticus, you know, whenever I read it. God help me. Well, the year of Jubilee, God set up a pretty amazing system. Every 7 days, there's a Sabbath rest, right? Well, in the land that they're going into, he said, just as you're to follow that pattern, well, the land is to follow that pattern. After every 6 years, there'll be a Sabbath year, a seventh year, in which the land will rest. Now, that's pretty awesome considering these guys knew nothing about crop rotation. Do you guys know anything about crop rotation? You know, I'm a farmer or anything, but if you plant continually on your land, you'll drain it of all its resources, and it needs to lie fallow for a while. So just God looking out for them in another way, but they were not to plant on the land. They were to spend the time eating what grew naturally on the land. Which I see that being a test of faith, especially if my business is farming, right? Or even feeding my family. But so there's a series of 7 days, a series of 7 years. Well, there's a series of seven sevens with the Sabbath. 49, 7 times 7 is 49, right? In the 50th year, this was the year of Jubilee. So they were to not even eat what had grown in the ground that year. So you ask, well, how am I supposed to eat? You could plant, you could harvest in the non-Sabbath years. In the Sabbath years, you don't plant, but you can still harvest. Now, there's no harvesting. There's no planting, there's no harvesting. And they say, how am I supposed to make it? And he says, well, I will give you so much food the year before. I'll give you 3 years of food in the year previous, so you won't need to plant. And in this year of Jubilee, in this 50th year, if no kinsman redeemer had stepped up to do what he was supposed to do, God says, I am set at resetting things. Families that had lost their land, get it back. People that had sold themselves into slavery. So if you're in great debt and you might do that. You might sell yourself into slavery so that you could to pay off your debt. And whether the debt was so big you couldn't pay it off, or whether the year of Jubilee just happened to come around, you were set free in that year. All the slaves set free. All the land returned to the families to whom it had originally been given. So the kinsman redeemer acted on the individual kind of family level, whereas God, the year of Jubilee acted on the societal scale. It was a reset. The promised land wasn't a place to make your fortune and to buy and sell, to make it where at your neighbor's expense. They were supposed to be bringing heaven to earth. Right? I can't stress to you how important community is to us as believers, to God as one of the huge applications of the Trinity is that there has been a community forever, and that we are invited into that community to share in the joy of that community. Creation, Genesis story tells a lot. The whole Bible tells tons about that. But this, you can see how in Canaan how it was supposed to be, that we still had our own property. We weren't commies, you know, that we still had our own thing. It wasn't some guy telling you what you had and didn't have, but it was also together. And we did sell it as our brothers had need. What an amazing picture what an amazing person this kinsman redeemer should have been. He's a person who remembered that he too was once a hopeless alien, who didn't view his stuff as his stuff, but willing to give it up, to restore what had been lost by another, and one who was going to bring justice and mercy together. To be a kinsman redeemer, you got to know your people. You've got to remember who gave you all you have, who it was that redeemed, and at such a great cost. And you've already met one. In the book of Ruth, Boaz is acting as it has been and will continue to act, as Randy preaches through it, as a kinsman redeemer who remembers his God and trusts in God to provide. I mean, Boaz wasn't even, you'll find out, Boaz isn't even really the nearest kin. To redeem Naomi's property that Elimelech probably sold, maybe abandoned, I don't know, during the famine, and then went out to Moab, leaving the house of bread to find food. You know, and Boaz, this righteous man who followed the teachings of Leviticus and Numbers, this gleaning, I think Randy talked last week about them leaving some of the sheaves. That's from Leviticus. So when you did that, if something fell to the side, you didn't pick it up. You left it for the poor and the alien. When you get, I guess you shake trees to get olives. When you shake your olive tree and some don't fall down, you leave it for the poor, the widow, and the alien. So you see Boaz already acting as in faith, and not going after the max profits. You know, and Boaz was a true kinsman redeemer. You know, when he marries, I wonder what kind of hit it took on his business. I wonder what kind of hit it took on his society, on his social standing to marry a Moabitess. I don't know. It seems like it might hurt his reputation. But they bear a son that they named Obed, and Obed was King David's grandfather. I mean, as you can probably guess, if you read your Bible at all, you know that God's people failed pretty miserably at being obedient to these commands, that Boaz was one of the few obedient kinsmen redeemers. Most of the Israelites, like us, lived for ourselves. They hoarded what they got, and they didn't remember what God had done for them. And in Leviticus, Moses threatens in this, well, God does, that if they didn't follow these commands, that the land would become desolate and they would lose, they'd be cast out of their homes. And the book of Kings and Chronicles and the prophets, you know, tell this woeful tale of God's failure, of God's people's failure to trust in Yahweh. And just as in Eden, they were kicked out of Canaan. I mean, was it ever going to change? Was there ever going to be a kinsman redeemer who would permanently, you know, buy them out of slavery and give them the land forever? I mean, enter Jesus, our ultimate kinsman redeemer. I mean, he became kinsman by taking on our flesh. That flesh, what I love about this, you know, that flesh, his bloodline includes some pretty shady people. I mean, Ruth was a Moabitess, Rahab was a former prostitute. I mean, you got a bloodline. When Jesus came in, he really did take on our flesh, born in a barn. Always poor. I mean, this wasn't some fairy tale of a God who comes down and pretends to be human for a while. I mean, he took on our skin. As a matter of fact, he still has on our skin. When he comes back, he's still going to have the scars that he bore from God for us. I don't remember the last time I mentioned this here, but like, think about this guy had BO. God, the God of the universe, went through puberty, was disciplined by his parents, who were always wrong. I mean, imagine that. This guy knew what it was like to suffer. Imagine, well, it doesn't take long for me to fall under temptation. How many donuts did I eat the other night, Rebecca? I decided we need to do something outrageous. I did. I consumed 8 donuts, I will say. Which I hope qualifies as outrageous. We were going to Costco, and I thought we should buy something outrageous at Costco. But we couldn't find anything we really wanted at Costco, so we did donuts. But I think about how the suffering is proportional to the amount of time you resist it. Right? I mean, I give in so fast sometimes, the amount of suffering is nil. But imagine never giving in to temptation, going through puberty, knowing what's going to happen. You know, just this guy took on our flesh. He truly is a kinsman. But he was also something more. He was there at the beginning. He remembered creating Eden, parting the Red Sea, bringing the Israelites out of Canaan. He remembered his promises. And Jesus did the ultimate buyback, paid the highest price that's ever been paid for his property and his people, for a people who willingly enslaved themselves. A redeemer who brought us from slavery. We were enslaved to sin and to death. And he paid his precious blood. He paid the full price of the debt. The full price. And that's something, too, that we gloss over. When Jesus was on the cross, he paid all of it. The wrath of God is portrayed as wine in the Bible a lot of times. You know, and he says he drank down to the dregs. So when God looks at you and he turns that cup over, there's not a drop that falls out for you. That's the price he paid. He paid it all. He paid the full price to set me free. Not only that, he put all the credit he deserved into my account. Into your account. He didn't just wipe the slate clean and say, here you go, Tim, good luck. It's better than Canaan. I mean, that's kind of, in a way, that's kind of what the Israelites had. Remember what I've done for you. Here you go. In some ways. Now, remember what I've done for you. Remember what I'm going to give to you. And you know, you got all my riches in your bank account. I don't know if you, have you sold yourself into some sort of slavery today? I mean, we're just like Elimelech. We leave the house of bread to find food all the time, all the time. As a matter of fact, I would just guess Elimelech probably held on longer than I would have in a famine, unfortunately. But I want you to know that your kinsman redeemer is at work. He'll bring back your squandered inheritance. You know, he brings back our squandered inheritance, and our inheritance is God. God is the only possession that makes a man rich. And that's guaranteed. If you're feeling enslaved, if you're feeling hopeless, if you're feeling like your life is falling apart, well, I mean, you fit well into the Bible story. The Israelites felt it. We feel it. But I want you to know, the blood of Christ didn't, there's not a drop that fell from his hands onto the ground that's not going to do its job. I mean, I read in a book sometime, and it's stuck with me all these years. The author almost turned to me and said, do you think that the blood of Christ fell from his hands in vain now? And not only that, there's a permanent year of Jubilee. Jesus is our Jubilee. He sets the slaves free. He redeems what was lost. He brings about, and this time it's permanent. This time we're not going to lose it. This time he suffered all the covenant curses so that you and I would never have to. So I can tell you this, whatever it is you're suffering today, it's not that. It's not being cast out. If you belong to him, that is not what it means. I don't know what it means. But I do know that he's going to bring it to a good end, to an end when you see it at the end, you're going to say, yes. I talk about this in my Revelation class, but in this apocalyptic genre, they talk about this picture of heaven with people singing for thousands of years. And I'm like, that is, you know, Michael might like that, but that's not my thing. that's not my bag, you know. And it seemed awful as a kid or whenever I read it, it just seemed awfully boring. And then one day it hit me, you know, it's not that we're going to have to be in the choir and like singing because we have to, but like you sing when something amazing happens, right? I remember screen printing. I pulled off this design one time of this guy. It was a full color thing. And I burst into a spontaneous song when I saw it. I never do that. But I was so excited because I was under so much stress that I was going to ruin this, and it worked. And I can't even remember what it was, but I burst into song. That's what it's going to be like in heaven when you see it finally, because there's just no way it's going to work out. I'm thinking, there's no way this is going to be made right again. But when I see it, and I see what my Redeemer has done, I'm going to break out in 10,000 years worth of song. Because he really did. He really is going to put it back together. He really is going to pull it off. He really did pay for it all. So this Christmas, you know, let's try to remember these things. Remember what Christ has done, the permanent riches we have in him. But also, you know, where can you be a kinsman redeemer? Where can you bring hope where there's not any? Where can you buy something back? You know, I think also the story of prodigal son, but the good Samaritan. And who is my neighbor? Who can you share some of your riches with? Who can you deplete a little bit of yourself, trusting that God will provide for you, that he will make things right? Where can you be a kinsman redeemer? For whom can you pour out your life and know that you're safe because you have untold riches waiting for you in the promised land? Let me pray for us. Oh, Jesus, I'm blown away up here by thinking about that day when I look and I see everything made right. It's just hard for me to imagine, but it does take my breath away at times when I finally get a glimpse of it. And I pray that you would smash that into the hearts of those that are struggling today, who feel like there's no hope, who feel like you've forgotten them. Lord, I'm sure in the waiting time, just as we're waiting for Christmas, but as in the years that the Israelites waited for the year of Jubilee, that we're waiting for you to make things right. But we don't have to sit there wondering. We can see you. We can know that if you really did come in the flesh, if you really did die on that cross, and if you really did get raised from the dead, that we really will have a Jubilee. We really are rescued, and we are being rescued. Lord, so please, please give us hope in this Christmas season that can be so hard for people. Help us to remember you. Amen.